Good evening. For the first time since the war in Ukraine began almost 11 weeks ago, a Russian civilian inside Russia has been reported killed. A Russian official says this occurred in a village in the Belgorod region. That area is about 6 miles from the Ukrainian border near Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv. Kharkiv has been repeatedly shelled, as you know, and there's been intense fighting in areas around the city. In just the last several days, Ukrainian officials say they've liberated a number of towns and villages near Kharkiv. Russian officials say the region where they reported the civilian killed has seen several explosions in recent weeks. The cause, they say, were missiles and bombs. Now, Ukraine has not confirmed nor denied responsibility for the blasts. Another major development today, a possible step toward Finland joining NATO. Its president and Britain's prime minister agreed to assist each other militarily should either country face attack. Finland shares a roughly 800-mile border with Russia, which has threatened military and political consequences should Finland or Sweden actually join NATO. This was the message from Finland's president to Vladimir Putin should that happen.
If that would be the case that we join, well, my response would be that you caused this. Look at the mirror.
So there's a lot to get to tonight, including a one-on-one interview with one of Vladimir Putin's most high-profile critics who's just made a daring escape from Russia. She'll tell us how she managed to get out. We start with the report of the Russian civilian killed. Joining us from Lviv, Ukraine, CNN's Scott McLean. So, Scott, the first time since this war began at the end of February, a Russian civilian has reportedly been killed. What do we know?
Hey, Anderson. Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, this is an area where the Ukrainians have made some progress in taking back some towns and villages around Kharkiv. And in those areas, they're, in some places, only a few miles from the actual border. And so they're telling civilians not to come back to those areas, A, because they're heavily mined, but also because they're within Russian artillery range. But now the Russians are finding out that they are also well within Ukrainian artillery range. And so, as you mentioned, for the first time, the governor of the Belgorod region just across the border says that one civilian was killed in this very tiny village just 6 miles inside the border due north of the city of Kharkiv. Other villages in that area have been evacuated because houses have been damaged or destroyed. Obviously, there have been other explosions inside Russian territory in recent weeks and really since the war began. The Ukrainians not exactly jumping up and down to take responsibility for them, with one notable exception, which was about 2 weeks ago or so, that they didn't explicitly say that they were responsible, but a presidential advisor said, quote, karma is a cruel thing, Anderson.
Ukraine's deputy prime minister is saying that Ukraine has offered to exchange Russian prisoners of war for the Ukrainian soldiers defending the steel plant in Mariupol. Has there been any progress negotiating with Russia?
I mean, this is something that President Zelensky says that he's been working on, even getting third party countries, influential third countries involved, to try to broker this kind of a deal that they say is quite desperate because there are hundreds of soldiers, perhaps hundreds of just wounded soldiers, who are inside that plant. The Ukrainian troops released photos that they say were severely injured people. They don't have medicine. They don't have proper medical supplies to take care of them. And so the deputy prime minister, who's been leading these negotiations with the Russians, has been running through her options. And basically she says, militarily, there is no way to extract these people. There's no way to get these soldiers out. They are also not going to surrender, which she respects. And so she's working on a third option. She says none of the options are perfect, but they don't need perfect. They just need something workable. And so at the moment, what they've proposed is to basically exchange prisoners for just wounded soldiers, not even the able-bodied ones, just the wounded ones. So far, the Russians aren't biting, but she also says the negotiations are ongoing. The soldiers have been here for about 2 months or so or longer, but perhaps they're not as ill-equipped as we thought as well, because according to a high-ranking Ukrainian general, there actually have been deliveries of aid and ammunition to the plant, multiple deliveries, and they only stopped once the Russians actually caught wind of this. What we don't know is what the delivery method was. Apparently it was taken out by Russian airstrikes. We don't know how many got in or when they were cut off. The Ukrainians, though, say that they have enough ammunition to fight off the Russians. That is for the moment, though, Anderson.
Scott McLean, appreciate it. Thanks. We mentioned the ongoing fighting around Kharkiv. Nick Payton-Walsh recently spoke to a survivor of one of the earliest and most memorable attacks on civilians in that area, and to her husband, who saved her life that day.
Sometimes places that speak only of death throw up a jewel of life. This is the first time Ayuna has stood in this spot since 72 days ago she was dragged out from the rubble here. Her husband, Andre, had been scouring it, looking for her, for 3 hours. She remembers the cupboard.
That was where I was standing.
The multiple rocket attack on this, the Kharkiv Regional Administration, was an early sign of the ferocious, cowardly brutality Russia would unleash on civilian targets. This is Ayuna then. She had been serving coffee and cookies to soldiers, saw a flash, and curled into a ball.
I feel a physical manifestation of fear. I don't like cookies anymore. A box fell on me and I remember the smell.
She asked to step away, saying she's sick with butterflies, like she hasn't felt since before races when she used to swim professionally. Andrei picks up the story.
When I heard her voice, I was crawling across the rubble, and the emergency services were trying to kick me out. I pulled a man out and then heard her. I did not plan to leave her here.
The soldiers waiting in the corridor outside from her died. The young women in the basement below her died, their bodies not found for 3 weeks. Yet somehow, the concrete here fell, shielding Ayuna.
I knew I was alive, in pain but nothing broken, but was worried I would be left and never be heard. The first time they heard me, they started to get me out, and the second missile came, and I was properly trapped.
A rescuer eventually heard her.
Andre got closer, and I said it was me, and he cried. They said they shouldn't lift the baton on me, but Andre did, alone. It got easier to breathe. I was surprised as I thought I was still at ground level. The ambulance guy said, "It's your second birthday. You're alive."
Fragments of a Kharkiv now past pepper this shell, cleaning up and trying to sweep away its trauma.
I sleep with the lights on, and when there's a loud car or, God forbid, a jet plane, I brace. The nightmares that I'm again lying there and shivering cold, and that nobody hears my cries, that also stops me from sleeping.
Ayuna was born in Russia, but can no longer talk to her relatives there. She says they believe Russian state media's absurd claims this is a limited operation against Nazis.
They say it was my stupidity and that I don't need to be here. I hope when time passes, our children can talk, but I can't talk to them now. Russia has lost its mind and cannot control its president. They are all each responsible, every citizen.
The story here, not of ruins, loss, or burial in dust, but instead of a feverish energy that burns through the building's bones, as Kharkiv gets to decide where its pieces fall now. Nick Payton-Walsh, CNN, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
Earlier, I spoke with someone else fortunate to have survived Vladimir Putin's brutality. Her name is Masha Alyokhina. She's leader of the performance art group Pussy Riot, who used a disguise to fool Russian police and managed to escape Russia just last month. She's now telling her story, and I spoke to her just before airtime. Masha, I understand you were already under house arrest and staying at your girlfriend's apartment in Moscow when the authorities contacted you. What did they say, and what made you decide this was the time to leave?
I was actually not under the house arrest. I was wearing an electronic bracelet, and I was under the sentence of restriction of freedom. And before that, I was under house arrest. And besides this electronic bracelet, I was arrested 6 times and spent 6 times for 15 days in jail. So I was like double arrested.
You've been arrested, and I think, 6 times since last summer. I mean, there was the original 2-year sentence back in 2012, but 6 times you've been arrested since last summer. I mean, that's extraordinary. So what happened this time?
This time I just decided that my tour was scheduled, and it's important to me to make a statement against the war as loud as I can and to speak as loud as I can what I've seen in Russia. So I made it a small change and decide not to spend this 21 day in prison, but spend it at the rehearsal studio with a new song.
If you can, tell us about how you got out. You said you had an electronic bracelet. What did it take to get out of the country? We have a picture of you and I understand your girlfriend Lucy dressed up as food delivery couriers. You're on the left, Lucy is on the right. You use that, I understand, as a disguise to evade the police who were staking out her apartment. How did you come up with that idea?
I think that was Lucy's idea, and she used it first. And then I used it when that was like my turn. But the thing is that I sneaked at this uniform from the flat, which was surrounded by political police. And also, I had a little bit more difficult situation because my international passport was confiscated. So
you didn't have a Russian passport. They'd confiscated it.
Yes. We have in Russia, all the citizens have two passports, internal and international. So for traveling, it's not possible to travel with internal. It's all in Russian and it doesn't mean anything for the world, only for Russia. So they took my international passport, yes.
You went first to Belarus. Was Belarus safe? I mean, because you've been critical of the leader of Belarus.
Belarus is 100% unsafe, believe me. Belarus is terrible dictatorship with the same crazy maniac in the power. But it's kind of only one way, you know.
And
if you want.
So from Belarus, you were trying to get to Lithuania. Were you, I mean, obviously they knew you had left by that point, or they knew you were somewhere. How long were you in Belarus, and where did you, I mean, you couldn't stay in a hotel, I assume.
No, I couldn't.
So,
well, I used my, I think, theater experience and help of my friends to stay at places without register with my passport.
So you had to then, to get to Lithuania, you had to cross the Belarus border with Lithuania. What was that like?
Well, that I succeed from the third time. And
it took you three times?
Yes, three times.
What happened the first time?
First time was nightmare. Second time was okay. They just said no. First time was terrible. First time was like search of me, of the car where I was. 2 hours speaking with terrible KGB investigator and so on.
Being there, I mean, is there relief or sadness and sadness? I mean, obviously you have been fighting inside Russia. You care about Russia. You want change in the country that you were born in. Is there sadness to be out?
Well, I was doing my activism, like half of my time I spent at tours, at doing lectures, and then each time I came back and continue to do activism and art in Russia. I just now feel that I'm as a holder of, let's say, Russian citizenship, I should help Ukraine just to give a small balance to all those horrible things which Russian army done, all these murders and raping and bombing should somehow be, I mean, I just want to do something good for Ukraine. And I think this is the only thing which we all can do.
At the end of February, when Vladimir Putin gave that hour-long speech on Ukraine's history, denying its statehood, essentially clearing the way for invasion, you were sitting in a jail cell, I understand, actually listening to the speech on radio. When you first heard that Russian forces had invaded Ukraine, what did you think?
What I felt? I think that was a combination of things. Anger and a shock, because I've understood that, you know, war started. And I mean, I'm dealing with this state for 10 years, and I know the methods which they use, and I know that they do not, that human lives is nothing for them. Human life is nothing. And yeah, that was just hard to accept. And I don't think that I accepted all the things which I saw during last 2 months completely.
You said to the New York Times that, I want to make sure I have it right, you said that Russia doesn't have the right to exist. You think it no longer has the right to exist. What did you mean?
Without war tribunal and without, let's say, denazification, it's, what is the sense? I mean, Russia invaded another country. It's people, innocent people, you know, being killed and raped. And you've seen the photos of bombed cities. How, I mean, I can't understand how we all can, you know, how the country can live with this in future.
It's
because more than half.
It's interesting you use the term denazification in Russia, that's what needs to take place. That's a term obviously they're using for Ukraine. Are you saying that, are you equating them, the Putin regime, to the Nazis?
Of course. Of course, yes. I mean, just look what they are doing. It's them who should be denazificated. They are doing genocide against Ukraine, against Ukrainians.
Masha Alyokhina, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come tonight, a Russian family divided after the death of a loved one on the battlefield. His cousin in America talks to CNN's Alex Marquardt about the grip that state TV has on those still inside Russia. Later, it sounds like the plot of a movie. A pilot is incapacitated and a passenger with no experience has to step in and safely land the plane. How it all turned out, coming up. Earlier, we told you the story of a woman saved by her husband after a Russian missile attack, but who couldn't talk to her relatives in Russia about the traumatic event, she says, because they believe the lies told by Russian state media. Alex Marquardt now has the details of a woman living in Brooklyn, New York, whose Russian cousin died fighting in the war, who says she's encountering the same attitude from a family that she says has been brainwashed.
Roman was just 19 when he married his girlfriend last November. He was already in the Russian army, and within weeks, he was deployed, not knowing he would eventually be sent into Ukraine. His sister posted this video on Instagram of Roman boarding a train, the last time his family would see him alive. According to Roman's cousin, Anna, Russian officials told the family he was killed by a mine. Anna lives in Brooklyn and is fiercely against the Russian war.
I want to believe that he felt that it was wrong. And maybe he, you know, tried not to do something that he was asked to do, that he was, you know, ordered to do. I just really hope, I just really want to believe that.
When the war began, Anna called a hotline in Ukraine looking for any information on Roman. The Russian army was offering none. Last month, we met Anna. She had only heard that Roman was sent towards Kyiv. Back then, she was afraid to show her face. Now, she wants to tell the story of her family, which has lost a son to a war that Anna believes her family has been brainwashed into supporting.
Do you think as Russian families understand how many of their sons have been killed
that that will change the opinion about the war?
I think that would happen little by little, you know, as they receive the badges and they, you know, see the outcome of this war. But they're so brainwashed.
I know it's very difficult to speak with your family right now, and a lot of them don't want to speak with you, but do you get any sense that their attitude is shifting?
If it's shifting, they're all afraid to speak about it. They're just intimidated. They're afraid, you know, they could be reported. It's just this fear around all this.
Roman's body returned to Russia in a coffin. He was identified by his father. The coffin stayed closed for the funeral, at which he was posthumously given an award for courage. Anna says the family had been waiting for any sign, a call, saying Roman was alive. Then a Russian official arrived with the devastating news that a mine had killed their son.
They were just patiently waiting, and then the official showed up.
Now, do they want more answers?
His father does. I know for sure that his father wants more answers. He just wants to know more what happened to his son.
5 months after cutting her wedding cake, Roman's wife is now a widow. And like countless Russian and Ukrainian parents, Romans have lost their only son.
They just abandoned the orders, really. And the people who started all this, they're safe. They're not in fights.
You feel anger towards them?
Oh, yes. Yes. It should not have happened at all.
And Alex Marquardt joins us now. It's sad because obviously she will probably face less sympathy from others because her cousin was fighting for the Russians.
Yeah, that's right. But she says that these are young men who are going off and fighting and dying because of the ego and the agenda of one man, Vladimir Putin. And then her cousin Roman, she says, joined the military because he needed money. Mm. And he sent that money, a lot of it, back to his parents. And then he was sent off very soon after his wedding, as you saw. He didn't know where he was going. He certainly didn't know that he was going to fight a war. She says that he was following orders. And we know that this war has become deeply unpopular with Russian soldiers. We know that the morale of the troops has been well documented. But at the same time, we know very well these are Russian forces who are doing terrible things in Ukraine. They are killing Ukrainian civilians. They're committing atrocities, possibly even in war crimes. So Anna says that all she can hope for now is that her cousin Roman is not or was not among those Russian troops.
Alex Marquardt, appreciate it. Thank you very much. Up next, breaking news on Capitol Hill. The January 6th committee is about to enter new territory, the public hearing phase. I'll tell you how that's going to work coming up. Plus, it's being called the miracle landing, how a passenger with no flying experience safely landed a small plane after the pilot fell ill. We have breaking news tonight from Capitol Hill. The January 6th committee is getting ready to kick off a series of public hearings in less than a month. The first one is set for June 9th. It's an important new phase as the committee continues to investigate the Capitol attacks. And as Jamie Gangel joins us from Washington with more. So what are you learning about these hearings? How is it going to work?
So what we know is we expect 8 hearings over the month, some during the day, some in prime time. We expect to see new evidence, new video, as well as some audio. Remember, Anderson, they have done nearly 1,000 interviews behind closed doors. So this is going to be a challenge. The committee has to put together presentations that incorporate that testimony, as well as thousands of documents, text messages, call records, emails, and there's still more coming in. We are told that the main goal is to show that even though Trump was told there was no election fraud by his own Attorney General Bill Barr on December 1st, and even though he was warned there could be violence, he continued to push forward relentlessly with this campaign to overturn the election that led to January 6th. We also know the committee is going to focus on 3 words, dereliction of duty, what Trump didn't do, that on January 6th, while everyone was watching the attack on the Capitol in horror, while his staunchest GOP allies, his families were texting, asking him to act, that Trump simply sat there for hours, reportedly watching television. There's one report that he was rewinding and watching it again before aides were finally able to convince him to make that video telling rioters to go home. I am told the committee is really going to focus on why he didn't immediately tell them to stop and to leave Anderson.
Do we know what witnesses are expected to be called?
So the committee has not, they are still finalizing the witness list. So thus far, our understanding is no one has actually received an invitation. That said, we know there are some likely people that the committee is going to want for the public hearing. So, for example, former Justice Department officials like Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen, his deputy Richard Donahue, also those top Mike Pence aides like his former chief of staff, Mark Short, his general counsel, Greg Jacob. And also we've been told that while there were videotaped depositions of members of Trump's family, like right there, Ivanka Trump, son-in-law Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., what we don't know yet is whether the committee is going to rely on those taped interviews or will call them back for actual public hearings. Our understanding is that it is unlikely that former Vice President Pence will testify in public, and it's also unlikely the committee would call former President Trump. I just heard this past hour that the committee may begin to reach out to potential witnesses as soon as next week, Anderson.
And do you expect any new revelations?
So they're still collecting information. I would not rule it out. I think that one of the things to remember is, for those of us who are old enough to remember the Watergate hearings, keep in mind that the bombshell of the Watergate hearings, when Alexander Butterfield, a presidential aide, disclosed that the Nixon White House had a recording system, that did not happen until the middle of the hearings. So I do think there are going to be some surprises, Anderson.
Jim McGangale, appreciate it. Thanks very much. Coming up, passenger turned pilot and hero after landing this plane after the pilot became ill. He'd never flown a plane before. How he did it next. In a scary situation aboard a plane leaving the Bahamas, the pilot became ill and a passenger who had never flown a plane before had to take control of the aircraft. CNN correspondent Carlos Suarez has details of how he managed to fly the plane and land it safely in Florida.
Caravan 333, Lima Delta, Fort Pierce Tower.
A new pilot has joined the ranks of heroes like Captain Sully.
I've got a serious situation here.
Except this guy is not a true pilot at all.
My pilot has gone incoherent. I have no idea how to fly the airplane.
Darren Harrison is a passenger who had to land this single-engine Cessna coming back from the Bahamas Tuesday after the pilot was incapacitated.
333 Lima Delta, Roger, what's your position?
I have no idea. I see the coast of Florida in front of me, and I have no idea.
Soon enough, the plane was located on radar about 20 miles east of Boca Raton, Florida, and air traffic controller Robert Morgan was urgently called in from his break to help Harrison, who was suddenly in charge of landing a plane.
What was the situation with the pilot?
He is incoherent. He is out.
For 3 Lima Delta, Roger, try to hold the wings level and see if you can start descending for me. Push forward on the controls and descend at a very slow rate.
Morgan's been an air traffic controller for 20 years and is also a flight instructor. He took us up in his Cessna today to show us just how he helped Harrison get out of the air safely.
This is our propeller, which moves the blades.
Even giving me a chance at taking over the controls.
I've never done this before. You get the call. Yeah. What's the first thing that I need to do?
He was kind of like stable, right? He was already stable at 3,000, so you're just going to grab the control wheel. Gentle, not a lot of pressure. It's like holding your first girlfriend's hand.
Teaching two novice pilots to fly in just 2 days' time.
So you have the control, so you're flying now.
If there was ever a moment of panic for either Morgan or Harrison, you would never know by listening to their calm exchange over the radio.
He was a really good listener.
And how good of a landing was it?
I would rate his landing a 10. So I've never flown that plane, and he landed it safely and didn't damage it and didn't damage. Nobody got hurt.
The two were definitely happy to see each other after the plane was on the ground.
You know, I was just about in tears. I didn't cry. I was trying to be strong and look very manly, but I kind of wanted to cry. It was just a lot of emotion. Gave him a big bear hug. Shook hands. I told him I owe him a cold beer. He said, no, I owe you a cold beer.
And Carlos Suarez joins me now from Palm Beach International Airport, where the plane landed. So how are the passenger and the pilot doing?
Yeah, so we're still trying to get a little bit more information on both the pilot and that passenger. We know that Harris lives just outside of Tampa and that he works at a flooring business, but a coworker there said he is a very private person and his family, they did not want to talk about what happened. As for that pilot, Morgan tells us that he did pass out after he complained about having chest pains, but that he was awake when that plane made that emergency landing and he was taken to the hospital, but his name and his condition has not been released.
All Anderson? Right. Carlos Suarez, appreciate it. Joining me now, CNN aerospace analyst and PBS NewsHour science correspondent Miles O'Brien. So, Miles, so many things could have gone wrong here.
Yeah, Anderson, if you think about it, a lot of things were stacked in the right direction. First of all, beautiful sunny day in Florida, an aircraft that was really docile, was in contact with air traffic control, and you had a very calm passenger. And then you had the fortunate happenstance of having an air traffic controller who was a seasoned flight controller able to get on the line. All of those things were very crucial to make that happy landing happen. You know, they say any landing you can walk away from is a good one. And I think if you pulled any of those things out of the mix, if it was a dark and stormy night, a more complex airplane, or if somebody had panicked, we'd be telling a very different story right now.
Yeah, I know you've looked at the flight path and the changes in altitude and speed. Or is there anything you gleaned from that?
Well, it's quite evident when the plane is being flown by a professional pilot, probably on autopilot, and when things dramatically shift. At about an hour into the flight, it plummets in excess of 2,500 feet almost instantaneously. That would really get your attention. Now, perhaps that was because the incapacitated pilot fell into the wheel or the yoke, as we call it, causing it to dive. Wow. But then you see, slowly but surely, it begins to return to control.
I mean, that's cannot be a good moment. I mean, we're watching that just take a nosedive there. How rare is this this has got to be pretty rare, yes?
You know, Anderson, this, as far as I know, I've only seen this in movies. You know, this is, we could come up with a couple of treatments here. We've probably seen this movie too, you know, Who Ate the Fish kind of thing. But this is an unusual scenario. Real hat tip to the air traffic controller, but also that passenger for staying so calm, cool, and collected. The panic is what kills you. You just listen to the simple, relatively simple advice here. This is, after all, an aircraft that is kind of an overgrown trainer. The Cessna 208 is a turbine version of a Cessna 172, which is what we all learn on. So it's not a hard aircraft to fly intrinsically. But, you know, in that situation, who knows how any of us would do.
I believe you were making an airplane reference, no?
Yeah, I was there.
Okay, briefly. Good. Good.
I had the lasagna. How about you?
Just lastly, if anyone out there ever finds themselves in this situation, you fly yourself, what do you recommend?
Give me a call. I'll talk you in. be cool. I'll give my cell phone number out to those who need this. But no, I do think this is an unusual circumstance. But most importantly, stay calm, get on the radio, call somebody for help. Don't do anything hastily.
All right. Good advice, Miles O'Brien. Appreciate it. Thanks very much. Up next, my favorite senior data reporter, Harry Enten, joins us to break down what we learned from primary results in West Virginia and Nebraska and what they might tell us about next week's crucial matchups in Pennsylvania next. Former president's influence over the Republican Party seems strong. Candidates he has endorsed are winning key GOP primaries. It includes his pick in West Virginia's second congressional district race, Congressman Alex Mooney, who voted to overturn the 2020 electoral votes. But his guy did not win in Nebraska's Republican gubernatorial race. Next Tuesday, the focus turns to Pennsylvania, where there are key Republican races. CNN senior data reporter Harry Enten joins us with his insight.
Sure, why not?
How you doing, Harry?
Hey.
He's my favorite senior data reporter, but for the record, you're also the only...
The only data senior, reporter only that data you know. Reporter. I should be that, you know, I got a chief title, but of course, a chief of one.
You need some
one.
Silver in your hair to really pull off the senior data reporter.
You know, my father didn't go silver till his 50s or maybe late 50s, so a little bit of time.
I'm envious. What takeaways do you see as far as where Republican voters will and will not tolerate going, what they'll tolerate going forward?
I think we did learn a lesson in Nebraska. And that is sexual harassment allegations will just simply not float with them. That's exactly what tanked Charles Herbster. And you can see that if you look at the polls before the allegations dropped, he was ahead with undecideds allocated. He was about at 36% of the vote. He ended up with 30% of the vote. And he did that with Donald Trump's endorsement. Mm. This is not a hard thing to figure out, right? Sometimes there are hard equations to figure out, but if all of a sudden you were at 36%, you drop down to 30 even with Trump's endorsement, and this fits with political science literature, right? This is the type of penalty that we might expect. So it does show that some of the normal rules of gravity still apply even within the Republican Party of today. Obviously, we saw a few years ago down in Alabama with Doug Jones being able to defeat Roy Moore, something similar. And I think, Anderson, we may see that in North Carolina's 11th district next week, right? Madison Cawthorn is running for re-election. He is receiving a strong challenge from Chuck Edwards. You can see the betting odds on your screen right now. It's basically dead even. Mm. This is the probability that they could win, and it's basically dead even. And you know what? This to me says something, because Madison Cawthorn was supposedly this rising star within the Republican ranks, and then he's doing God knows what. I mean, every single second, there's a scandal breaking on it. Yeah. I mean, who knows? There might have been one during this hour. So, look, Republican primary voters, they love Trump, but they're only willing to talk.
Trump is backing Cawthorn.
Yes, he is backing Cawthorn, though I should point out that Tom Tillis, the state's junior senator, is in fact backing Chuck Edwards. He also has the backing from some major state legislative officials in that state. So there are a lot of Republicans who are just not willing to tolerate the BS.
I feel like you're yelling at me.
You know what?
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's your thing, but it's fine.
My voice.
I know. You're an actor. You're a thespian.
I can talk like this. It makes you happy.
No, it's fine. Be yourself. So, I mean, what do we know about an endorsement from former President Trump? Because it's clearly helpful in some places, West Virginia, for example.
Yeah, I mean, look, overall, it's been quite helpful. 4 to 5 this month, Donald Trump has gone in what I would basically call competitive races, right? These are ones where there wasn't an incumbent running, or one incumbent, right? In West Virginia, you had two incumbents, McKinley and Mooney. Or in the case of Nebraska, right, you had no incumbents running. Pete Ricketts' guy ended up winning that race. Pete Ricketts, the governor, who basically, adios amigos. So look, having Donald Trump's endorsement is helpful. Mm. But the real question is, what happens when you take away the scandals? Can he, in fact, put someone over the top who really doesn't have any quote-unquote scandals, but perhaps is a weak candidate? I think next week in Pennsylvania, we're going to get a real test of this. Dr. Oz is running in that race. He received Donald Trump's endorsement. He has seen a bump in the polls. But if you look right now at the numbers, this is a Fox News poll that literally came out last night. Look at this. Up and down. Oz, McCormick, Barnett, Kathy Barnett, up to 19% of the vote.
And she's spent like minuscule amounts compared to the others.
Minuscule amounts. Now, she is getting some support from the Club for Growth. But this is going to be very interesting, because as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Oz doesn't really have a scandal. He's just a weak candidate. If Trump gets behind a weak candidate, can you really put him over the top? If Barnett wins that race next week, maybe the answer is Donald Trump isn't as strong as we think.
Although she's very pro-Trump.
Oh, she's very. Yes. Look, if you're running in a Republican primary these days, it's very hard to win without being strongly pro-Trump outside of maybe some, you know, Northeast cities and perhaps in the state of Utah. You have to be pro-Trump. But the question is, how much is that Trump endorsement really worth? Mm-hmm. Can he put someone over the top who's truly weak? Can he put someone over the top who basically is running against a popular incumbent? That's not the case in Pennsylvania, but it is the case with Oz being a weak candidate.
In the Pennsylvania gubernatorial race, Doug Mastriano, who we profiled on the program, he's what does the data say about his chances?
He gonna win most likely, Anderson. He is most likely going to win. If you look at the polling data, look at that. 29%.
Are you doing a Southern accent for Pennsylvania?
I don't know what the heck I'm doing right here. I'm having a good time. That's what's shaking. Okay. I think I'm getting folksy insofar is that he is going to win, and it's shocking. Mm-hmm. This is a chief election denier, right? This is the Democrats' dream. Josh Shapiro, who's going to be the Democratic nominee for governor, is licking at the chops. He wants Mastriano.
Weren't some Democrats pushing commercials to get Mastriano?
Yeah, I mean, this is just it's just amazing to me. But it looks like he is going to win that primary at this point.
And turnout, what are the numbers showing that?
And turnout, what the numbers are showing is Republican primary turnout across the board relative to the Dems in 2018 up. Republicans, this is another sign that it's going to be a very strong November for Republicans.
All right. Harry Enten, appreciate it. Thanks.
Shalom, my friend.
All right. A New York judge today said that he will lift the civil contempt charge against the former president only if he meets several conditions, including providing sworn statements on his use of Post-it notes. Details next. A New York judge today said he would lift a civil contempt finding against the former president, provided that he meet a number of conditions, including paying $110,000 in fines racked up for his slow response to a civil subpoena issued by the state's attorney general. A reminder, the attorney general's office is investigating the accuracy of financial statements the Trump organization provided to lenders, insurers, and for tax benefits. He must also provide sworn statements describing document retention and destruction policy for the family business, including their handling of Post-it notes, which it was known to use to communicate with his staff. The judge also wants a review of five boxes tied to the former president that were located in an off-site storage facility. The conditions have to be met by May 20th. Otherwise, the judge says he'll restore the contempt finding and apply it retroactively. The news continues right now. I want to hand it over to Laura Coates in CNN Tonight. Laura?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.